Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, to another edition of Amandla, your Amandla Radio, your weekly news show on that with analysis and briefings on the continent of Africa. And we have a very interesting lineup today. I'm going to talk to rebroadcast an interview I did with a trade unionist who was very active in the anti-apartheid movement with the SACTU Solidarity Committee back in the 1980s. And it's very exciting to hear somebody who's so clearly anti-imperialist and clear on what's the role of trade unions and international solidarity. So Gwen, what have you got?
Nice. Thanks, Doug. Yeah, I had a great conversation with Frederic Mousseau. He's the policy director of the Oakland Institute out in California. The Oakland Institute does a lot of on-the-ground research in collaboration with people, communities, and organizations that are confronted with land grabs, and we often turn to them for their analysis. And so this, sadly, is a story that is now 10 years old. It was back in the day, the Senegalese government declassified a nature reserve in order to lease it to an Italian-owned agribusiness company. The community has been fighting ever since, and now the news is that that company has been sold to a U.S. concern, African Agriculture Inc. So the community is now contending with a new company that is continuing to pursue this land dispossession, water dispossession. Frederic is always very eloquent and clear in terms of what is going on, and is again this time. So I encourage you to take a good listen. At the end, he has some suggestions about how people can learn more about this and take some action. Right. 10 years ago, the government of Senegal declassified part of the Ndiaye Nature Reserve in order to lease it to an Italian-owned agribusiness company. Recently, U.S.-based African Agriculture Inc., or AAGR, acquired that land. Back then and now, the 10,000-plus people whose livelihoods depend on that land have been completely cut out of the process to devastating effect. Joining us today to talk about the implications of this latest transaction is Frederic Mousseau, the policy director of the Oakland Institute. Frederic, nice to have you back on Amandla.
Thank you, Gwendolyn. Lovely to be back with you.
So let's start by talking about the new player in this story, African Agriculture Inc. What do we know about them?
It's a company which is registered in New York City, but they own the project in Senegal through a subsidiary in Cayman Islands. And they have this complex maze, and this is quite typical for this kind of project. So they have a branch in Delaware, which is a U.S. tax haven. And then this branch has another subsidiary in the Cayman Islands, and which is another tax haven. And this one is the one owning Ferme de la Teranga, which is now the new project in Senegal. And what we know is that you have a U.S. more like a financial investment specialist who is the CEO of this company, and the owner is Frank Timmis, who is a tycoon who has a long history of dodgy deals around oil and minerals in Africa. He's originally from Romania, but is this kind of international players with investment in different sectors, especially these extractive industries.
So what is their stated goal in terms of how they plan to use this land?
It's, again, it's quite typical. They're going to do all good to Senegal. It's all about creating jobs, creating fodder so that the pastoralists can feed their cattle. It's about economic benefits because they want to export their production to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia.
What's that production? What do they want to grow there?
So they want to produce alfalfa, which is fodder. And it's very cynical because this land is the land of the Peul in Senegal, who are agro-pastoralists. So they use this land for pasture, to get grass for their grazing grass for their cattle. So for decades or centuries before that. And then you have this company that comes and put fences and say, okay, this land now is going to be ours and we're going to grow fodder for cattle. Mm-hmm. So you take grazing land from people to produce fodder that you're going to export to the Middle East. And that's a story, and that's how cynical the project is.
Yeah. Okay, well, as you've alluded to, this land, which was once part of a forest and wetland reserve, is critical to the livelihood of some 40 villages in the area. I'm understanding that's about 10,000 people who are directly impacted by this. So can you tell us a little bit more about the Peul in that area, how they're being affected by this dispossession, and in a bit more detail in terms of their relationship with the land?
Yeah, sure. It's, first I could share how we got involved in this project. But one day in 2011, 2012, we got a delegation from this community that went to Dakar in the capital in the office of an NGO to contact us and ask for help, basically, because they felt nobody was with them. The government was giving the land away to this company. You had this powerful businessman who were involved, and they're seeking. So they come down from the northern part of Senegal in Saint Louis to the capital to seek assistance from local NGOs as well as from groups like us here in California. And so the Peul are traditionally agropastoralists. So they have mostly livestock, and they use the land extensively. So they don't have ranches. They have a rather mobile use of land, an extensive use of land where they move from place to place with their cattle. So they have no relation to this concept of private property of land or fencing, because they have this collective use of land where you go to the communities share the available resources for the cattle, and they move, and they consider the land and water as common goods that can be privatized and can be fenced, and this is the basic of their livelihood. So this land was before it was declassified by the president of Senegal in 2012. It was a reserve, a wetland reserve, on which they didn't have rights for cultivation, but they had all the rights to bring their cattle, to collect wood, to collect medicinal plants, to collect food. And it was pretty good also, because outside of the reserves, you had farmers who were farming land. And we know in Sahel, you have all this sometimes difficult relationship of the land between farmers and pastoralists who have to move their cattle. And so that was a good deal with the people with livestock who could use the reserve and just graze there without doing any damage to it, because they were just grazing. And then they had a good relationship with farmers outside who were using the rest of the land for farming. And all this collapsed with the arrival of this Italian firm in 2012 that put canals and fences and started the project there 10 years ago.
So this is a 10-year-old story now. What has been the impact on their herds? Are they, do they even exist anymore?
Yeah, it's been, I have to say, it's a story of this 10 years is also a long story of resistance and community mobilizing for their rights. So they don't have titles to this land. It's really saying like, our ancestors have been buried there. We've been using this land forever. Okay, so this was officially government land and a reserve, and the president can just sign a decree saying, okay, this won't be a reserve anymore. We're going to give this land to a company. So legally, all this might be, the paperwork might be okay, but this is our land. And people have been resisting for over 10 years against this takeover. They resist without titles, without lawyers. They just claim their rights to land and rights to live in dignity in this part of the country. And on the other side, you have the government, and you have very well-connected individuals in the some of the owners and executives have all kind of connections in all kind of businesses, including many different companies set up, and you can see like powerful businessmen in Senegal facing people who are just with their cattle and goats and cows in this land. So it's a story of resistance and of
this. What does that mean? I mean, have they been cutting down fences in order to be able to continue to graze their animals?
They've been several years ago, they actually took over a certain part of the concession so they could still use it. They've been writing petitions. They've been organizing protests. They had, in the past, several moments of negotiations where they tried to negotiate with the company to have something for them. So it's been ongoing between protests, at some point we even learned from them they were putting their own fences on the land to have their cattle. But they have some production. They have been able to secure some land like this, so they have some production, but it's still very complicated for them. So there's a lot of frustration. They have to move around with their cattle. They have all their traditional routes for moving cattle and people have been affected by this. A lot of the cattle get injured because it's not just fences, it's barbed wire fences that they've put there. And so a lot of the cattle get injured. And this is one of the big concern at the moment that they keep raising, is that we have all these injuries in our cattle. And so they are used to a difficult, these are tough livelihoods in the Sahel part of Africa, where you have to move with your cattle from place to place to find grazing land. So they used to this difficult life, but it has been more and more difficult over the years, and they still want their land back. And just that last month, on May 30th, when they heard about this project, they wrote to the newly created American company, U.S. company, to ask them for the land back, and as well as for compensation and remediation for the 10 years they've been without their land. It's
and the response. Guess, what was the response?
The response of US CEO of the company is that the company is doing good. I mean, basically, the company ignores the demands, but they say, but look, we're doing very good for the people. We provide jobs, we gave fodder to some people, and we made contributions for the Ramadan and Eid holidays. So you see how good we are. And it's pathetic to see in this US CEO arriving there saying, okay, I'm going to give you a present for your Ramadan and give you a few contributions here or there to some people, and then I'll have this land. And it's pathetic also. I mean, pathetic may not be the right word. It's shocking also when you see their business plans. They making these small contributions. People there are really struggling to survive, and they have to dig to get water to drink. It's really harsh living conditions. But the business plans of this company is really talking about millions of dollars of profits out of this. So of course you can make some contributions for Eid and Ramadan and try to look good, but at the end of the day you've taken people's land and you can't ignore their demand, even if you have your paperwork in place and sign. There's something which is deeply immoral in this kind of attitude and project.
So what's the community's response to this now that that's a new ownership that seems to have a similar mentality? Are they looking at different tactics? Are they, you know, becoming resigned? Are they becoming radicalized by it?
They just received the the response from the company. So it's going to take time for them to meet and gather and discuss between each other. I think the one area they have been considering was whether to go to court. And but then you need to hire a lawyer. You need to go into a process that's going to take a long time. So it's a difficult route.
Yeah,
and especially it's difficult and costly, and it takes time. So that's what they were talking about. But they may also consider other tactics. We are in touch with them. We report and echo their voices and their concerns. At the moment, they are discussing about this project. They've just learned recently about this new project, because there have been several owners, several productions, several plants. There have been all kinds of things happening on this land, and they always hear about it through the news.
They're the last to know. Yeah,
I was actually in Dakar in March. When they, with one of the representatives of this group, and when they learned from social media that these investors were there and they were starting to produce this alfalfa for export to the Middle East, and they were shocked. And I was with our friend Aldo So, who is the representative of this collective, who has been really leading the fight. He was telling me, oh, his mother and ancestors are buried on this land, and we hear from on the social media about this bunch of European and American investors coming to use this land for exports. It's just shocking, and a lot of anger and frustration on their side.
Where are the political representatives in this story? I mean, Senegal has what the world recognizes at least as a democratic process, democratically elected government. Where are their political representatives in this story?
This is a project that was first, the lease for the land was first given by the previous president of Senegal. And then there were elections, and the second, the next president who is in place now, Macky Sall, signed another decree to change the location of the place. But so both former presidents were willing to make the deal, and at the expense of the local communities. I mean, the current and the former president, were ready to make the deal with this foreign company for this land at the expense of these communities. And it's, I mean, I don't know what really triggers this kind of decision when we know that these people are using the land and it's essential for them. What we know generally on the continent is that pastoralists and agro-pastoralists are the first to be targeted and losing, because they have this extensive use of land. They don't have titles. They don't have their parcels clearly identified. They are considered by central governments as backward, because they are this old traditional livestock grazing activity. And we need to move into modern Western style agriculture, which means these big farms, big tractors, and I mean, what we see on TV, what's happening in America. Mm-hmm. So that's what politicians are thinking. This is, if we want to develop Africa, if we want to do business, we need to move large scale and industrial, and these people are in the way. And unfortunately, it's kind of mindset you see a lot on the continent, and it's wrong, because what we've seen over and over again is that actually this livestock livelihoods based on livestock, like the Pearl are doing in this part of the Sahel Strip, is actually one of the most effective ways of using resources in a sustainable way, and more effective than doing plantations when you think economically, when you think in terms of return for the local population, when you think also of the climate and the use of resources. And in this kind of area, it is wetland, but it is a semi-arid part of Africa where the way you use your resources is critical. The project is going to take water from a lake, which is called the Lac de Guerre, which provides 60% of the drinking water of Dakar. It's an essential source of water for all this area there. And they're just going to pump this water to grow crops that they're going to export to the Middle East. And in Senegal, the water crisis is dire at the moment. People in Dakar are protesting for their water and to have basic access to drinking water. So when you think of the politicians in Senegal, as unfortunately in other African countries, there's this pressure to attract investors, to modernize, to say, okay, we're going to go like Western countries have done, and this is the way. And this will bring us business, it will bring us growth, and growth would be the way to take us out of poverty and out of our problems. But unfortunately, when we see projects like this, we really don't see this promise to materialize anytime soon. It's going to be very profitable for a few businessmen associated with the project, for the US company for sure, which is going to make millions. They just went for a public offering, by the way, at the stock exchange in the US. They are seeking $40 million from investors in this project. And so it's big money that is there, and it is going to be they're going for a public offering, so it's going to be investors on the stock exchange who are going to look for a profitable investment in this kind of project.
Yeah.
While we can really wonder what would be the benefits at the end for the Senegalese and especially this poor population in the area.
Yeah. It's also a reminder. I remember it was either the Oakland Institute or perhaps Grain that put out a report some time back that said that, you know, land grab is often really about water grab. That they're tightly linked, and access to water is often inherent and sometimes even the supreme concern in these kinds of...
Completely. It's, I mean, we both are friends at Grain. We've been working very closely with Grain on this, and we are both working with local communities there. And we both had reports around this and research around this, and it's very obvious that when... It's interesting because you have a narrative which is quite often, oh, there's so much land in Africa that is not used, and there's so much we could do on this land that is arid and not used by Africans. But when we see these kind of projects, they always come next to a source of water. And this is in the project documents and the SEC filing of the company. The water element is key, and the rights to water, how the company has secured the water usage rights, is key and is really an asset they put forward, and they see that as essential for their project. So they're not going to go to dry areas where they won't have any water and where nobody's using the land. They're going to an area which is with very significant water resources and where they can use these water resources, and it will be at the expense of the local population.
So is this part of a conversation in any way in Senegal? You talk about how they're going to be taking water from this lake that is, you know, that Dakar depends on and other communities depend on. So has it sparked a conversation in the country? Does the media look at this? Are people aware that this is going on?
Yeah, it's. You know, I was in March. I was in Dakar when I was there. It was for the World Water Forum, and I was actually participating to the Alternative Water Forum organized by the civil society, mostly Senegalese groups, in Dakar, and there was very, very significant mobilization of Senegalese civil society around water in urban centers and rural water as well, because there's a big trend of privatization of water. So there were protests. People have been arrested and beaten because they want to protect their access to water in Dakar. And there's a big movement happening at the moment. And there are actors such as the French and Canadian multinationals coming to run the water systems for the population, for the cities of Dakar and other cities around. And people are protesting because then it raises the water usage for the locals. And then there is also this growing awareness around this kind of project that is also going to pump water out of the common to serve some interest. So there is mobilization, but there is also what is felt, what you hear a lot in the media, what you read there, is really the realization that the country has a water crisis and that people are really the victims of the crisis at the moment, and solutions have to be found. And at the moment, what we see as solutions is rather privatization, so that these groups can run a water system in an effective way. But what we see at the end of the day is rather privatization of common goods for the benefit of a few, and then the access to water that is going to be really unequal, depending if you have money or not, and which is going to be a growing issue in the country. And we know that with climate change, it is something that is going to grow as bigger and bigger concern every year.
Has there been any militarization around this issue in the community, and the dispossession of the land, the pushback against that? Has there been any kind of violent response by the state or by private contractors to the community?
Yeah, well, there was some years back at the beginning when they were installing the fence and preventing people from crossing. So they had their security guard and they had police. The most violence actually happened before the project started, when they actually with the first presidential decree, the Italian firm that was allocated land in a different place, where people again, and it's again everywhere, people don't want to lose their land and their livelihood. It's just their basic rights that is gone. And so initially they started in a different place, and then they went to protest against this deal, and two people were killed. And this was 2008, 2009, I believe. Two of the protesters were killed by the police. And then after that, they moved to this different place where in the current place of the project. And there hasn't been this kind of abuses and killings, but more the sort of intimidation and beatings. And I guess people are aware that violence can be used against them. So no, I mean, no use of the military as far as I'm concerned. But I don't think there's been much violence involved in the protests so far. And people have been trying to mobilize, but they are very peaceful mobilization and protests always.
So for those who'd like to learn more about this, maybe find a way to get involved and voice their concerns about it, where do they go and what should they do?
So they can check out our website, oaklandinstitute.org. And on this website, we have this report and we have a lot of information. I mean, we have the last press release, we have the older report we had prepared. We give also links to the company's filings, and you can find, I mean, this is a company, African Agriculture Inc., who is doing a public offering in the US seeking investors for this project. And what the communities wrote in May was asking for compensation and remediation. and for the land back, but it was also asking the company to let the SEC, as well as the Security Exchange Commission in the US, as well as the investors of the land situation, because nowhere in the public offering documents, the company talks about the fact that you have 37 villages disputing this land deal and asking for this land back and asking for compensation and remediation for 10 years without this land. So it's completely overlooked in all the publications of the company. So it's important that in North America, anywhere where there could be potential investors in this project, people are aware that this is not just land that was empty and suddenly is going to be super profitable with no liability. There's a very big liability, which is the thousands of people who have lost lands and livelihoods to this project, and they need to be they can't be ignored. You have to respect them and do something with them and go talk to them and see what to do.
Frédéric Mousseau, thank you so much again for joining us, and we'll keep on this and see what happens next. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you, Gwendolyn, for echoing this this work and the voices of the people. It's important they heard, and I think today we have this chance with the technologies that communities from the northern part of Senegal can reach out to us, and we can echo their voices and their concerns, especially in this case when we have companies coming from North America to exploit their resources and then dispossess them in West Africa. Yeah. So thank you.
Merci. You've just been listening to a conversation that I had with Frédéric Mousseau, who is the policy director at the Oakland Institute. Big thank you to the Institute and to Frédéric for that. You're listening to Amanla here on CQT 90.3 FM.
Yes, Gwen, I've been working, as you know, with the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Activist History Project with them. We are them. What has happened has been an outpouring of interest from across the country in getting those histories recorded from old activists, and it's been exciting. And amongst them has been the South African Congress of Trade Union Solidarity Committee from the 1980s, SACTU Solidarity Committee, that I had been part of and worked with. And we have been doing interviews 3 a week now for the last 2 months, so we're really getting them out. And last week, I just interviewed John Clark, a British immigrant to London, Ontario, who was militant trade unionist and then was laid off. And his union hired him to set up activities to help the unemployed workers who had been laid off. And so he eventually turned that into, over many years, he became a powerful activist in anti-poverty campaigns and worked with the Ontario Campaign Against Poverty, OSCAP, which was a model in Canada of resistance to neoliberal policies and anti-worker government. So he makes a very direct link between international solidarity and the workers of South Africa and Canada. He's a strong anti-imperialist, and he talks about how SACTU Solidarity and their work was such a key role, played such a key role in helping unionists understand that link and make it happen as a real, moving beyond words and tokenism to practical, concrete support for workers of another country. So stay tuned. Really interesting. I had to edit it a lot. I'm so sorry, but it's a great interview. Good morning, John Clark in Toronto, I believe.
That's correct, yes.
John, the obvious starter question is, could you just give us some background, where you come from and how you came to be involved in activist labor and anti-apartheid kind of issues?
Yes. I was raised in London, England, and I came to Canada in the in the later part of the 70s, and set up in London, Ontario. I was faced various challenges in terms of unemployment, and finally found myself a job working in the Westinghouse plant in London, where I was a member of UE Local 546. And I was a shop steward and union activist. And that's where I had a level of involvement with the SACTU Solidarity Committee initially. And then in 1982, I was laid off from my job and got involved in an initiative to form initially an unemployed committee within the local that I was part of. But then that became an initiative to form a city-wide organisation of the unemployed. So I remained in that kind of role right through until recently with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, based in Toronto. And in my capacity as an unemployed organiser, I also had some dealings with the SAC2 Solidarity Committee, and our organisation was supportive of that committee's work.
So do you feel any time that you could remember that you became really aware of, for instance, apartheid and how important the struggle in South Africa was for the kind of struggles workers were going through here?
Yes, I mean, I think you had, it was clear that internationally, apartheid South Africa was something of a bulwark of reaction internationally, and very much part of the strategy of global capitalism at that time, a very ugly legacy of the whole process of colonialism and imperialism in Africa, and that a very vital struggle was taking place, but that moreover there was that was interwoven with the class struggle in South Africa to an enormous degree. So what appealed to me about the SAC2 Solidarity Committee was that it embraced internationalism very much from an activist working class perspective that I thought was so valuable. So the struggle against apartheid, I think, was in many ways, and the international movement of solidarity that arose around it, was very much a cutting edge of international activism and struggle at that particular point.
Wow, fantastic. UE is United Electrical Workers. Were they an easy union to sell the anti-apartheid message in?
Yes, I think there was some more, a higher level of immunity to Cold War poison in UE than
existed. Very delicately said.
in many unions at the time. So there's no question that, UE generally was, I think, bound to be supportive of the work of the SAC2 Solidarity Committee from a clear-cut ideological position. The local in London was not perhaps as directly connected to initially, but it was precisely the work of the committee that really brought the local into being much more actively supportive. I do remember an occasion when ended up, this is one of the first times I met Ken, but I do remember being in a hotel in Toronto somewhere, and a speaker from South Africa was giving a little sort of talk to people that had been invited to the hotel room, and I went with the then president of the local in London, who didn't have a great background in activism and didn't have a great understanding actually of the issues. And I remember that this meeting for him was an epiphany, you might say. I mean, he was so affected by and so moved by what the brother from South Africa had to say, and the struggle and the enormous injustices that were being challenged, that it was clearly a defining moment in his life as a trade union activist. So I don't think we can understate the degree to which that element of anti-racist struggle and international solidarity had inspired the work of Canadian trade unionists.
Wow, that's amazing. Your union, would they have gotten involved with the strike fund as well? And how did the union manifest this support?
Yes, I mean, clearly in terms of, hosting meetings, providing space, providing resources, the support was there. I mean, I refreshed my memory by going over the list of those who had financially supported the work of the Sacktooth Solidarity Committee, and certainly our UE local in London, along with another number of other locals, were certainly supportive. And I must say, with some small level of pride, the London Union of Unemployed Workers, when it was formed, which was not exactly a resource-rich organisation, also made modest donations to the Sacktooth Solidarity Committee. So that support was clearly there.
Ken, Jane, do you have any questions?
I'll just jump in a little bit. Just a brief reminder. Meeting John in London, I want to refer to the Labour Council, which are very supportive in London, supportive of Sacktooth. And we did on many occasions have South Africans, as John said, pass through the country, giving talks across the country, mobilizing support. And I remember one meeting in London, Labour Council, and I'm not sure that you were there, John, perhaps you were. There was an example of the Cold War politics of the day. We had the Sacktooth Strike Fund, and we were getting tremendous support from unions, public and private sector, all across the country. And this was very much upsetting to the CLC International Affairs Department, who would have wanted the money to go to the CLC. And so when Zola Zembe, on one of his trips to Canada, had made the presentation and the argument for the Sacktooth Strike Fund, a very progressive brother by the name of Al Campbell in London made a recommendation, a motion at the Labour Council that the Labour Council contribute financially to the Sacktooth Strike Fund, fully understanding that it was for underground work and would not get a receipt and the usual kinds of niceties of the labour movement. So Zola made the argument, Al Campbell made the motion, the CLC rep present at the meeting intervened and said that he would have preferred on behalf of his organization that the money go to Ottawa for further disbursement to South African workers. Zola then got the microphone back and said that, Zola got the microphone back and said, you could give the money to the CLC. You could also go to Lake Ontario and just throw it in the water. That would serve the same purpose. So that was a sharp definition of the politics of the day. The CLC and its Cold War politics directed by the ICFTU in Brussels versus the mobilizing that is reflective of the kind of work that John has done. So I remember that meeting, and I'm not sure if you were there, John, but that was one of my memorable events in London.
Yes, I was there, and I do recall it, and I remember the role of Al Campbell, who was in many ways Al played a remarkable role, and yes, I think that really did bring it home. Is that by taking up a struggle for working class international solidarity that embraced the struggle and the class struggle in South Africa, that's where it was playing such an important role, because we still were dealing with, as you say, the Cold War at that particular point. And we had a situation where the CLC veered towards, instinctively almost, lining up with the foreign affairs priorities of the Canadian state, let's say, rather than remembering its duty to the international working class. And that was a moment where that was sharply challenged. And the London District Labour Council did play a supporting role in the face of that rather, I'll be diplomatic and say, stodgy bureaucratic obstruction. And it was very, very indicative. And in my mind, it's entirely interwoven with the struggle that we were taking up to form an effective organisation of the unemployed, which was similarly regarded with distaste and obstruction. And the two things sort of came together at that particular time. We were both in our own ways, in our own context, trying to really take up an approach of genuine class struggle as opposed to bureaucratic accommodation and foot dragging. And it was a moment where that approach got pushed back by the really solid working class sentiments that were there in that room.
Wow, amazing. And can you just take us, for a start, I'm also very interested in some of these names that we may not probably get to meet, like Al Campbell. Yeah, could you just tell us a little bit about him that would make him an important actor in this kind of struggle?
Yeah, Al was at the time the vice president of the London District Service Workers Local 220, which was part of SEIU, a very, very progressive local that in its own right played a very, very important role in supporting the SAC2 Solidarity Committee. But Al was a truly remarkable figure. He was from Cape Breton. His partner Jeannie Campbell was the president of the postal workers local in Toronto, and both of them were really a thoroughly inspiring institution for the left in London, Ontario at that time. And Al had been connected. I mean, he was an older man at that time, so he went had memories of struggle going back to the Great Depression, and all the struggles that had taken place in Cape Breton and such like, and so within that local, which represented primarily hospital workers, he played an incredible role. But he was one of those people who has a good solid sense of militant working class politics on the domestic front, but who link that to a deep-seated sense of internationalism. So for Al Campbell to not speak out against the apartheid regime in South Africa would have been inconceivable. It was absolutely inevitable that he would be there, ready to challenge the bureaucratic stodginess and the foot dragging, and giving a clear example. As we got organised with an initiative to form an unemployed union, similarly, Al Campbell was probably. His contributions in terms of removing impediments, ensuring that there was genuine support put forward and such like was absolutely outstanding. He's one of the people who I always look to as a great example of a solid working class activist.
And I'm also fascinated by the unemployed workers movement that you got involved with, and that they people who had such serious concerns here in Canada about their own welfare would be able to take on that internationalist role so willingly.
Yes, I mean, I think we brought around us people who wanted to fight back. The LUUW was formed in the context of one of the 1980s recession. So
the
London Union of Unemployed Workers, excuse me.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, was formed in the context of the international recession that was hitting hard at that time. So it meant that, generally across the board, there was lots of job loss, but there was lots of job loss within the unionized companies as well. And so what we found was that it brought a lot of the people that were thrown into that situation were often activists prior to that situation. But if they weren't, the experience of being hit by unemployment at that particular period, having to turn to the unemployment insurance system and then to the even more dreadful welfare system, that tended to radicalize people. And our organization offered a perspective and a fighting perspective. So again, I mean, it didn't seem to us a kind of a, I mean, obviously you fight where you are and you focus on the struggles in your own community. But to give the best support we could to the struggle of South African workers seemed to us an extension of the whole perspective and the whole fight that we were taking up, and an absolutely necessary one. And I've always been struck by that. I mean, you get someone like Zola Zembe that was referred to, that appears before a group of workers here in Canada and speaks with conviction and understanding of a struggle like the struggle in South Africa. And the way that resonates with people, the sort of the class instincts and the fighting spirit that kind of thing brings out, just can't be underestimated. That the importance of international solidarity, of which the SAC2 Solidarity Committee is one example, but the importance of that kind of really grounded, practical international solidarity and the implications for the kind of struggles you can take up in your own community and your own workplaces, I don't think can be underestimated.
That's fantastic, John. Thank you. My goodness, Jane, Ken.
I'm glad you mentioned Local 220 of SEIU, which we probably wouldn't otherwise put at the top of the list of progressive unions in that day. But the local in London was unique, not only because of Al Campbell, because many of the staff people, older comrades, had been to South Africa as part of the Canadian Navy. They had seen Durban. They had seen apartheid with their own eyes during the World War II. So I remember having no difficulty whatsoever convincing Local 220 executive and ultimately membership that they should be on side with SACTU. They worked very carefully around the whole Ormer's pension plan, trying to get divestment and disinvestment strategies working on that front. And they're very good on identifying commodities, South African commodities, in SEIU workplaces. So I'm glad you mentioned Local 220 because they definitely deserve a lot of credit in those days. John Askin, in particular, the president, I believe that was his name.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. So, I mean, that was the striking thing about the local was the breadth of its connections in terms of and influence in terms of struggles, very practical, direct struggles. I remember there was a brutal strike by primarily, largely Portuguese women who worked for Canadian linen in London. A strike that was, I mean, they just worked to crush it. And there was a mobilization that took place. And I remember the role that activists from 220 played in ensuring that those picket lines were strong and that a victory was finally achieved. So they could struggle, you know, on the most practical and immediate trade union question, and yet have enormous interest in helping the unemployed organize, mobilizing on issues of international solidarity, but not in an abstract way, but as you say, in ways that where they would actually look for the connections, the points of the choke points, as they say, the points at which they could have an effect and where solidarity could be expressed in concrete and important ways. Because I think that kind of an initiative, I think we still, and I mean, by raising money and awareness and acting to build practical, concrete support for the struggle in South Africa, it pointed to something that's always stood me in good stead. You know, like when you get when workers in another country ask for support. You know, it's standard to sort of say the right things and, you know, sort of send a give some token measure of support. But there's so much more we can do if we think it through. I mean, and I think that's an example of the kind of ways in which we, to this day, and that I think in some ways the most important thing to say about the SACTU Solidarity Committee is the foundations that it laid. That so much international solidarity work is based on earlier initiatives and based on very specifically the South African struggle. And it applies today, and I think we need to explore it and develop it even more than has happened in the past.
And that carried over then, I presume, as you've just explained, to the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty as well, when you moved to Toronto, and these kind of links with anti-apartheid would have continued even after SACTU, probably the Solidarity Committee was finished.
Yes, I mean, continued to maintain connections in terms of South Africa. Yes, with for the duration of the struggle against the apartheid regime, and I must say with poor people who are organizing resistance in South Africa today in the post-apartheid context, which has its own very severe contradictions. I don't think we can deny for a moment. And then more broadly, I mean, perhaps one of the greatest contributions and areas where that contribution lives is precisely in the struggle to build solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, which I think is very deserved comparisons are being drawn today with the challenges and the struggles and the injustices that are being confronted today by Palestinians compared to the apartheid era in South Africa. I think it would be a significant political initiative to actually. I mean, everybody talks about the fact that, you know, we're we're confronting a regime that has many of the features of an apartheid regime at the moment, and trying to give solidarity to a vital liberatory struggle that's taking place. And there are real comparisons to be made to the struggle. In fact, in some ways, I mean, what reminds me of it so much is there was a whole period when challenging South African apartheid was seen as being something that was beyond the pale, that you didn't want to challenge South African apartheid. You wanted to pretend that it was eventually going to go away because things were going to become kinder and gentler, and you didn't want to be disruptive and all that kind of nonsense. And that's being raised today in that same context. So, I mean, I think there are really rich lessons where we could get beyond just a sort of a vague notion of there are some comparisons. I think they should be fleshed out, and I think they should be really clearly so that those lessons of that earlier struggle can be applied in ways that are useful to the struggle that's taking place today. Just to say thank you so much for the opportunity. It was incredible to remember some of these things, and I really do think that the point I was making is absolutely fundamental, is that the struggles that took place are like the shoulders that we're on, and that's there for us, and that example of the struggle of the SACTU Solidarity Committee and the influence that it had, the legacy that remains and still reverberates, is something really precious. So I think it's so important that those things are brought together. I mean, I've been involved in unemployed anti-poverty struggles, and you look back at the incredible history that took place, and unfortunately, so much of it has been lost. So much of the incredible struggles that took place at earlier times have only been in the most spotty way documented and recorded. And of course, we live in a society where the working class memory has to actually be fought for, because they're not going to encourage you to establish that record. So to leave that record for others who come afterwards is such an important thing. And this is such a great project, and I'm so proud to have made a little contribution to it.
Thank you so much for tuning in with us again here on Amandla. Doug and I are going to be taking a little break over the next couple of weeks, our summer vacation. It's been, a long, difficult road under COVID, somewhat isolating. So we don't usually take a break on Amandla, but this summer we've decided to give ourselves a vacation. We will miss you. We will be happy to be back. But in that time, we're also going to be restructuring the show. So we're looking forward in 2 or 3 weeks or so to be able to announce a new format to you, a kind of a new and rejuvenated Amandla. So during our vacation, we are going to be putting some of that together. So have a good couple of weeks. We'll be rebroadcasting some of the best of Amandla while we're away, and then back with new material when we return.
Music and anti-fascism, reflections on the past and possibilities in the present. Join us for a concert July 7th. Featuring Egyptian Cotton Orchestra, Montreal Free Jazz, Kim Dong Wong, Free Improv based on Korean traditional music, Skunk Heaven, New York City Noise, on July 7th, 2022, at 9 p.m., La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. For more information on the concert and conference on protest music and anti-fascism, music and antifascism.wordpress.com. This concert, with generous support from Suoni per il Popolo and Popolo Press. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
Good evening and welcome to the I'm Taff Live Radio Hour. You're tuned in to CKUT.ca 90.3 FM. Pre-recorded in these pandemic times in quarantine studio with your hosts, Anna Basin, DJ Choosy, and I'm Dawn.
Special quarantine tribute to Maurice Ravel's legendary melody and tune, Bolero. We're going to be listening to nothing but Bolero for the next 2 hours, so strap yourselves in, folks, and get ready for a ride.